This is CliffCentral.com.
Please note that the views expressed and the advice provided in this show are for general advice and entertainment purposes only. Nothing stated should be treated as a substitute for your own independent legal advice based on your own specific facts and objectives. Therefore, the presenter and CliffCentral.com accept no liability of any nature whatsoever, either expressed or implied.
Law, like you've never heard it before. The Laws of Life, with Gary Hertzberg on CliffCentral.com.
I'm Gary Hertzberg, and this is the Laws of Life on CliffCentral.com. Alongside me today, Lionel Makokotlela. Welcome, Lions.
Dumela, Gary, and Dumela to our podcasters. And today, of course, we have the greatest brilliant minds in the legal field. I think today's show is going to be an intellectual orgy, because we've got like the greatest, the smartest guys in the law field coming.
Yeah, in their fields, they are top of the range we got today.
Cream of the cream. This is what we do.
Lions, in the last week or two, the Gauteng Department of Health has had it bad, real bad. The tragedy is that their staff were forced to sit on the floor because the sheriff of the court rocked up with trucks to remove their desks, chairs, and computers. Can you believe that?
It's quite amazing, because during my dissertation moment, when I was actually doing my MBA, because my research was actually looking in the health aspect to see how total quality management can improve service delivery, it was quite shocking insofar as the litigation amounts that they were facing. And in most cases, in some hospitals, they actually did not have resources as a result of litigation processes. So this is just a very serious problem that is actually affecting people who are actually poor, who cannot actually afford to go to a normal clinic where they actually have to pay something.
Okay, well, let's hear what happened with the sheriff as well. A good point you make there, Lines. Mm-hmm. The sheriff of the court not only removed the furniture and computers and that, he went to FNB and he attached 14 of the department's FNB accounts, and thereby blocking the department's use of these bank accounts entirely, which is very sad. And the reason for this mess is that the department had not paid 33 million rand that it owes by court order to four children, only four children, who were brain damaged at birth by provincial hospitals within the department's hospitals. The attorney acting for these children got the absolute murin and decided to give the department a bloody nose, resulting in the department screaming, "Take me to hospital!" Today's show is about medical negligence, and joining us in studio are the two specialists that Lionel mentioned. Firstly, Johannesburg attorney, you know all about him because he advertises all over the place. It's Stephen Flowers of Munro, Flowers and Vermaak.
Attorneys,
absolutely. Stephen and his firm are well known in medical negligence, personal injury cases with over 20 years of experience. A warm welcome to you, Stephen. Thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon, Gary, and good afternoon to your listeners.
Great to have you. Your advertising budget must be millions, but that's cool. As long as you're delivering, we're happy. Yeah. Joining you today is Greg Whittaker. He's an actuary with the company known as Algorithm Consultants and Actuaries. And you're going to hear about from Greg that in medical malpractice claims, the actuaries are the ones that actually determine by mathematical calculation what a person's damages is going to be. Otherwise, it's really, the courts have said, it's basically a thumbsuck. So Greg is literally, I know him personally, he's so clever that he can even calculate next week's lottery numbers for you.
Well, certainly. I mean, actuarial scientists, they're like the smartest cream of the cream.
Yeah. At the end of the show, Greg will give you the numbers for next week's lottery, so stick around.
I'd love that.
Yeah, Lionel thinks you've got more of a chance of the lottery operators posting you a check by mistake than actually winning the lottery.
How about 40 million?
Yeah. Some of the questions, Lines, that have been asked today come from our collaborative partner, Legal Talk SA, on its Facebook page. They now have a membership of over 130,000 people.
That's great. Yeah. I mean, this partnership of ours is the collaboration, I like to call it. It's actually just growing every week. We seem to be getting more questions in pertaining topics that relate to law, and that is what we want. We want to serve the communities, and we want to ensure that they actually get the best of the best to actually offer them their answers. And that is why today we have the brains of brains in our studio to actually answer those questions.
Our Facebook page, The Laws of Life with Gary Hertzberg, have a look at it. Give us a like if you can. Our Twitter handle, Lines, you give that one out usually.
At Hertz
Law. Don't mess it up, Lines.
At Hertz Law, H-E-R-T-Z-L-A-W.
Okay, Stephen Flowers and Greg Whitaker, gents, you're both in the medical negligence space. Do you think that the removal of the department's furniture and attaching their bank accounts was the way to go to enforce payment? Stephen, you want to take up one?
Yeah, if I can start with that. I think that what you've got to understand is that this was a last-ditch attempt. This is a desperate attempt by the attorney acting on behalf of those particular plaintiffs that you mentioned. Because what happens is when the courts make an award, there is a judgment given or there is an agreement and it's made an order of court and it says pay X amount of money. So in this case, the MEC was ordered by the court to pay, I forget the figure that you mentioned.
Yeah, 33 million roughly.
Okay,
yeah.
Well, that was between the claims that was owing. So a total of 33 million was owing, and I don't know, there was three or four different judgments. Mm. And they're supposed to pay immediately upon the judgment, but of course one normally gives them a reasonable time within which to pay, a couple of weeks or so. And obviously this didn't happen. I assume that the attorney and who was dealing with the matters wrote to the Department of Health and asked, you know, for payment, would have produced a copy of the court order, and nothing was forthcoming. And I don't know how long these judgments had been outstanding, but I assume it was a fairly lengthy period of time. And eventually the attorney has no alternative. The only way to proceed forward if a debtor, in this case the MEC, is not paying, is to get the sheriff to issue what we call a writ. And that writ is then, you give it to the sheriff, it's issued by the court and taken to the sheriff, and the sheriff will go down there, and the sheriff must attach the goods of the debtor. And when he attaches those, and there's two things you can do. You can either just attach the goods, or you can order him to attach and remove the goods, which is what appears to have been done in this case. And then those goods would then go and get sold on auction, and whatever's realized for that would go towards the debt. And if there weren't enough movables to satisfy the debt, then they would go back, and then they could go against the immovables. Although in the case of the state, it's a problem. That's a different issue, which I don't think we need to go into. Mm. But what you've got to realize is that this was a last ditch.
Is it malicious? Is it spiteful?
It's not spiteful at all, because you know, there's a judgment. There are kids here in this case that have been, I don't want to say harmed by the state, but there's been negligence, and as a result of that negligence, these kids have suffered damages, which damages were determined by the court, there was an award made by the court, and the health department must now pay that award.
But do they have the money to pay it? Is that the issue, or is there just negligence or non-caring? What's going on? You know, why?
Well, whether or not they have the money, maybe Greg can answer that question. What I can tell you is that I've been told that each hospital, provincial hospital, that's what we're talking about here, is responsible for payment of any judgments against them from their own budget. So each hospital gets given a budget for the year, however many millions or billions they get in a year, and whatever they've got to pay out of that, and that would include any judgments against them, has to be paid out of that hospital's budget. That's what I understand.
Yeah, Jack Bloom, DA Gauteng Shadow Health MEC, said, "We attempted negotiations with the department, but no response was forthcoming." So I think even the DA gets involved in trying to sort these out.
Yeah, well, you know...
Well, Jack Bloom is very... He follows us very closely, and he knows all about it. I think you know him quite well, Greg.
Well, he's just given me quite a bit of information over the years, but I don't know.
What's going on? I mean, why can't they pay this?
Well, as Stephen said, the money comes out of the general budget. So the Gauteng Department of Health's budget for... the current financial year is about 40.2 billion rand. So there's not there's no sort of separate insurance fund or any provision that's made. It basically just comes out of your out of the general revenue.
Okay, so they self-insure the department.
Effectively, yes.
And whatever comes out of this $42 billion is money less that can go towards healthcare.
That's correct.
How much of the $42 billion do you know of their budget is used to pay off litigation claims?
We don't. We know what their provisions are. So I mean, if you look at, well, I mean, we could look at the trend. What's been happening over the last sort of 6 years. So, in their financials for the year ending March 2011, they had a contingent liability for medical legal claims of about 772 million rand. And then the latest figure in the March 2017 financial statements, the contingent liability for medical legal claims is about 18.6 billion rand.
So 18 billion must go towards past claims and out of the 42 billion that they've got to run the hospital.
Not necessarily. So that's the amount, what I understand, in the provision that they make is basically the value of the summonses that they receive. So a matter may not necessarily settle for the summons amount. It could be more. It could be less. So it's just a broad indication of the problem. But hypothetically, if the 18.6 billion claims were all succeeded and were valid, then that would have to come out of general revenue.
Yeah, it's rather tragic that. The hospitals are suffering and they can't deliver. Generally, they can't deliver, and it's kind of a vicious cycle or circle, whatever you call it, because they can't deliver. More babies are damaged and hurt, and more people are damaged and hurt because the department doesn't have the money to look after them. It's kind of quite simple, isn't it? That's what's going on here.
Well, I think if I can just step in here, I don't think that's quite true. I think you've got to start at the beginning, and the beginning is that a woman who's about to give birth pitches up at the hospital. She's in labor. She comes to the hospital. Now it's the job of the hospital to make sure that labor goes smoothly, that birth happens smoothly. We're not talking here about operating theater. You know, we're not necessarily talking about operating theaters. We're not talking about somebody who's been in a car accident, who's come in and who's bleeding excessively from the head and got brain damage and has to be rushed off to theater immediately. Otherwise they're going to die, or they're going to suffer some severe long-term trauma. This is somebody who comes in and ostensibly there is nothing wrong with the baby. When she comes to that hospital, that baby is fine. Because what we are talking about here are cerebral palsy kids. And what you've got to remember is the cerebral palsy kids, where there is liability, there are lots of cases where things happen in utero that are not the fault of the doctor. They're not the fault of the gynecologist or the obstetrician or the nurse or whoever. And babies come out, let's say, not normal. And that can be a congenital problem. It can be many other problems, which is nobody's fault. Now, in order to have a claim, there has to be negligence to start with. So you've got to remember that's your starting point. That means that somebody, be it a doctor or a nurse, didn't do what they should have done in the beginning. And that is, as a result of that, you've got a child that is now cerebral palsy. So what we've got is we've got negligence, which you have to prove. It's not something a child is born with cerebral palsy, pay them 20 million rand. It certainly doesn't work like that. You've got to prove that somebody didn't do what they should have done, and as a result of them not doing it, that's what we call in law causation. So it's not just negligence in a vacuum. That negligence had to have caused a result. So in the instance we're talking about, somebody didn't do what they should have done. They were negligent in not doing what they should have done at the time. And as a result of that negligence, a child was born with cerebral palsy, which is now going to require lifelong care. If they had done what they should have done in the beginning, that child would have been born normal.
Is there a common thread? Is there a common negligence here? Why are there so many kids that have been born this way with cerebral palsy? What is the problem?
Well, I can only speak from my experience, in cases that I've dealt with. And most of the time, you will find that this occurs in the second stage of labor. Mm. So it occurs a couple of hours before the child is born. Now, what they should be doing is they should be monitoring children. For example, at the hospitals, they've got a monitor that they put on the mother, which, without getting too technical, it monitors the heartbeat of the baby. And if the heartbeat of the baby drops below a certain point, that should be a warning sign, for example. And you can see it on the printout that comes. That should be a warning sign to the doctor or nurse, whoever's in charge at that point in time. It may be a midwife, that this baby is now going into stress, that the baby is now stressed. And when the baby is stressed, it means it's not getting enough oxygen to the brain. Mm-hmm. Because when it's in the mother, it's still in utero, the oxygen that it's getting is through the umbilical cord. It's the blood supply. So it's not breathing on its own yet. It's not yet born. And these warning signs, that's why they have these graphs that they attach. And when the doctor or the nurse sees these warning signs, they should take appropriate steps. And if that appropriate steps means that they need to take the woman to theatre and do a cesarean, that can be set up generally within about a half an hour.
Do they have the facilities in the smaller hospitals?
In the smaller hospitals, a lot of them do not do cesarean operations. They don't have the capability to do it.
So they've got to move them, is that?
But they should recognize the signs early enough, and they should then make sure that they're transported to a bigger facility, which then has it has the capability. Yes, there are cases, Gary, where things happen and nothing can be done about it, and with the best will of the world, the child is born cerebral palsy, but everybody did what they could do. Mm. But there are many, many more cases where children could have been born normal and are not born normal because things were not done timeously.
Of the many, many medical malpractice claims you handle, are most of them against government, or when it comes to kids that are born cerebral palsied, or are a lot of them against private facilities?
I would say that there are more against government than against private facilities. Mm. But certainly there are those. There are a fair amount that are against private facilities as well.
Yeah, I'd also say that's a similar trend that we've seen. Most of the cerebral palsy matters tend to be against the state, although there are a few private ones.
We all know this, that the Guyanese obstetricians are paying nearly R1 million per annum for medical risk insurance, which is crazy stuff. And they just cannot survive. So a lot of them are getting out of the profession. And ultimately, unless you're really very, very wealthy, you're going to be forced to take your baby to a state hospital to be born. And that's a bit of a concern with all these claims against the hospitals.
Sorry, Gary, just to add to that, I think the issue that the hospitals themselves are facing is the fact that they don't have adequate resources. In most cases, you'd find that they are doctors, but they don't have resources. And as a result, trying to actually save a life, and in some cases, they try to do the right thing according to their ethics, but then only to find that at a later stage, there are some consequences of their decision-making. And this is where then the law and the ethics come to play.
Yeah.
And the reality of the matter is that if then somebody actually is going to be suffering for the rest of their lives as a result of not having resources, whilst the money is there but mismanaged, who has to take the blunt? The state has to do that. And I really think then the state needs to be proactive enough to make sure that the hospitals are adequately resourced.
Well, are they being mismanaged? Is that an emphatic statement?
It is. I've got backings insofar as my research in this area, because I'm very passionate about healthcare. Mm. And I really found that in most cases, you find that the hospitals don't have medication. In some cases, even simple gloves. So those are some of the serious challenges that most doctors who work in public hospitals tend to face on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, Steve, you want to answer that one?
Well, it's difficult for me to answer. I don't work in the hospital, so yeah. I can't really comment insofar as the money's being mismanaged in the hospitals. I really don't know about that.
Yeah.
But what I can say is that I think that in the major state hospitals, I've seen many people come through my office, and when, you know, if we're talking about the baby cases, so to speak, as we are, I've seen many instances where women and needed a cesarean and got a cesarean. So, you know, the facilities are there, in, you know, for cesarean operations to be performed. Mm. It's a question of recognizing that that needs to be performed. And that comes back in to training. I mean, are the nurses adequately trained to recognize? Because there are a lot of cases where the nurses do nothing. And I'm talking from personal experience now. Yeah. And where the nurses don't recognize that the child is now in stress and there's a danger to the child. So nothing gets done. A doctor doesn't get called. Nobody gets called. And the result is that this child is then born with cerebral palsy, which needn't have been the case.
Yeah. The Department of Health has approached the Constitutional Court very recently, a month or so ago, and they said that they just can't afford to pay out these enormous amounts. What are they asking to do? What were they asking to do? And we are awaiting that judgment. Let's hear from you, Greg. I think your people were there in court.
Yeah, well, we actually originally did the calculated the lump sum that was due to the plaintiff. And
how much was it, roughly?
23 million.
A cerebral palsy as well?
Yes. So the department approached the Constitutional Court, and they basically raised three main issues. The first one was really that the lump sums that they're paying are preventing them from providing basic healthcare services due to the strain placed on the annual budget. Because as we said previously, this money just comes out of the annual budget. Mm. The second thing that they raised was that they suggested an alternative to lump sum payments. So what we have in our law as it stands is something called the once and for all rule. So basically you have one shot at claiming damages, and damages are paid in a lump sum. What they suggested is that the department can pay service providers directly after 30 days after receiving quotes for services. So for example, if a child needs let's say a wheelchair, then they have to get a quote, and then the department will purchase it, and then that happens.
Is there merit in this argument? I mean, does it sound right that they should, that someone that's injured should wait for their money to be paid as and when?
Personally, I don't think so. I mean, often because you have a lump sum, it gives you, you know, if there's an emergency, then you have access to funds.
Is a lot of this money that's paid in a lump sum not possibly squandered by the family, or is it very closely monitored, Stephen?
Well, if I can answer that, no, it's not squandered by the family, because in nearly all the, well, certainly all the cases we do, and as far as I'm aware, nearly all cases, normally a trust will be formed. Mm. So that money will be, because it's not the parents' money, understand that. It's the money that for the child, for its future needs and care. Mm. And sometimes that child is going to outlive those parents.
Yes.
So the money is paid in, a trust is formed, the money is paid into the trust, and the trust manages the money. So anything that needs to be purchased for the child needs to be put to, or come through the trust, and the trustees need to authorize that purchase. Mm. So for example, practically what will happen is, we all know that the child is going to need ongoing nappies, they got caregivers that look after them, for example. So the trust will then set up a mechanism whereby the caregivers are employed, the parents will employ the caregivers, and on a monthly basis, the trust will probably pay the caregivers directly from the trust. Things like nappies and milk and all those sort of daily consumables that the child is going to need. Normally what would happen is the trust would sit down with the parents and work out how much they need per month to be able to buy all of those things, and would then provide the parents with that amount of money to enable them to go and buy those provisions for the child, because it would be ludicrous that every time that mommy runs out of nappies, she's got to go to the trustees and say, I've just run out of nappies, I need to buy another packet of nappies.
Yeah, sure. Greg,
I think it's just at the end of the day, the liability is the same. How you're going to go about paying it is another story. But I mean, if you're going to pay it in installments or a lump sum, you still have to show the same liability on your books. So, I don't quite understand the argument of paying out in installments.
How did the court view this one? I don't think the judges were too impressed, or the evidence presented wasn't great, was it? I think the judges gave the advocate for the state a tough time.
Well, the reporting in the media was certainly along the lines that they grilled the Department of Health on the fact that they didn't present evidence in terms of how this is affecting the budget and so on.
Yeah. How would it affect the attorneys who are working on contingency? Would they only get paid on what they get paid out? Or how would this be monitored? It's quite a tough one, isn't it, Stephen?
Well, I think that if you're talking about contingency, I assume you're referring to the Contingency Fee Act,
yes.
which is a legislated act. And I think what you've got to understand about that is there's a misconception about it. And I know there's been a lot in the media about Contingency Fee Act lately. An attorney who's acting on a contingency fee basis is entitled to charge. Well, there are two ways of doing it. Either they can charge, they charge their normal hourly rate,
which is what roughly?
Well, it depends on the attorney's experience. I mean, you'll find that attorneys who only have a few years experience are charging less than attorneys who have 10 or more years experience. Mm. But they charge whatever their particular hourly rate is, and they take the case on spec, so to speak, so that on a no win no fee basis. Mm. And
who finances people like Greg, the actuaries and the specialist reports?
Well, the attorneys are paying for
you,
that.
We're paying for that.
Yes. Yeah.
So you outlay millions at any one time, depending on the number of cases you have.
Yeah, that's correct.
I think people got to understand that it's not just plain sailing for you, and you may not succeed in the end. So you could lose all that money.
It's a risk that you take. And with medical malpractice cases, you know, there's a lot more risk than, let's say, case against the road accident fund where somebody went to the back of somebody else. Mm. But to come back to the contingency fee thing, there's two ways of doing it. So the one way is, as I was saying to you, you just charge your normal hourly rate and whatever it comes to on a no-win, no-fee basis. So there's no cap on that. It's the amount of hours that you've done. Mm. The other way in terms of the Contingency Fee Act is that you're entitled to charge what they call a success fee, and that success fee being double your normal hourly rate. But then there's a cap on that to a maximum of 25%, whichever is the lesser. So, for example, if double your normal hourly rate comes to less than 25% of the award, that's all you're entitled to charge. Mm. If double your normal hourly rate comes to more, then you're entitled to only charge 25%. Mm. But that would exclude disbursements. On top of that, there would be the disbursements that are incurred to run the case.
Let's take some questions from the Legal Talk people, then we'll come back to what we were talking about. Lisa writes in. She says, I need some urgent advice. Fine, you've come to the right place. My friend's 12-year-old son died over a month ago due to natural causes. She puts that in inverted commas. But we've just found out that the results of the autopsy, and it shows it's basically because of the doctor's negligence. She wants to sue, but not sure how to start this process. As she gives some more information, she says initially he had headaches, and then it developed into paralysis. She took him to a private GP who wrote a letter of referral and so on and so forth. She landed up at a government hospital, and I think the kid was maltreated in some way or another. And I don't want to go into the facts too much, but she says the following. She cannot afford a lawyer. That poor child would be alive today had they done the scan or whatever they had to do. So what does she do?
Well, look, in a case like that, let's accept there was negligence from her story. Let's not debate whether there was or wasn't. We don't have enough information. But let's accept that there was negligence. When you're dealing with the death of a child, from a legal point of view of claiming, it's problematic. And the reason that it's problematic is that when you're dealing with the death of anybody, what arises from that is a dependence action. And in other words, an action for loss of support, because generally somebody has been deprived of support. When a child dies, it's a harsh thing to say, but the reality is nobody has been deprived of any support when a child dies. Mm-hmm. In fact, if it's my child that died, I would have been supporting that child. The child would not have been supporting me. So if I died, my child would have been deprived of the loss of support, and there would be a claim. When a child dies, there isn't a claim because there isn't any loss of support. So
what about heartbreak? Is there no claim for that?
There is a possible claim for that, but those sort of claims are not big. You'd still have to go through and prove the negligence in the first place, which is an expensive exercise to do. Mm. And you do get claims. And I actually looked up some of the awards that have been made in terms of claims for what we call emotional shock. Mm-hmm. That would be the claim. It's really a general damages, if I can call it, kind of claim, for the suffering that the parent has gone through at losing the child. And just to give you an example, a fairly recent case which was, it was a 2016 case. The damages awarded there, this was, in essence, I won't go into the facts, but it was a failure to take reasonable steps to prevent the stillbirth of a child. A child was born, it was a stillbirth, and it was found that if the hospital had taken reasonable steps, the child would not have been stillborn. There, the court made an award of 100,000 rand. So our courts are very conservative when it comes to making those sorts of awards. And I've got a whole long list here. And if I go through the list of old cases which have been updated, it's between 100, 150, 160,000 rand.
Now, for the loss of a child.
For the loss of a child.
Unless, Greg, you can prove that he owed you a duty of support, or he was going to support you, or how?
I mean, parents do have a claim if the child is working, but then there's quite a strict indigency test that has to be applied. So, recent judgments have also been fairly strict in the application of indigency. So.
Assuming the parents cannot work, aren't working, they just can't get jobs or whatever, would they have a claim for loss of support? And the child is stillborn. Well, you know, you've got to wait 18 years.
No, there wouldn't be. We can't claim for what would have happened or could have happened. The law looks at the facts of what did happen. Mm. And the fact that that child had an earning potential if it was born alive, that is not what our law looks at. Our law simply says the child was not born alive.
Mm. There's another question here. I think Sherelle Kiston, she answered in some way. She said, contact the HPCSA, which is the Health Professions Council. It's free up to a point where they advise you whether you have a case to go to court with. Very good attorneys on their panel. Gents, is this where people should go, Steve?
Well, I think what listeners have to understand is that if you're going to go to the Health Professions Council and lay a complaint against the Health Professions Council, first of all, is the body, the umbrella body under which all the healthcare professionals fall. So they all belong to that body, the same as attorneys belong to the law society, the various law societies. And if you're going to go the way of complaining to the Health Professions Council, they will look at it and they will decide whether or not to take any action once against the particular healthcare professional once they've looked at it. But it's not a civil claim. They don't have the power to make civil awards. So all that they can do is they can say, yes, we believe that healthcare professional didn't do what he should have done. And therefore they can slap him with a fine. If it's more severe than that, they can suspend him. And if it's the ultimate sanction would be to remove his name from the role.
I think she's better off going to an attorney. He can report the doctor if he wants to or not.
The attorney can, but I believe that if a member of the public wants to report them to the Health Professions Council, my own belief is that they should be the ones to do that. I don't encourage people to report healthcare professionals who've made an error to the Health Professions Council. Okay. Often, you know, you've got to remember that often when these cases come up of negligence, it may be a doctor, let's say he's maybe a well-known doctor who's been practicing in the field for donkey's years, and we're all fallible, and he made a mistake. It wasn't a malicious mistake. There was no intent behind the mistake. So, you know, it's up to the individual as to how they feel about it and whether they want to report their doctor, because that the Health Professions Council has the power to sanction the doctor ultimately. But if somebody has been wronged and they're looking for money in order to facilitate the future needs of that child or themselves or whoever's suffered the harm, then they're going to have to go through the court system. They're going to have to issue a summons against that healthcare professional claiming an amount of money. You're not going to get that from the Health Professions Council.
I think there's all the answers that were given to this very woman who said, what do I do about my son? A lot of people said, go to the Law Society, they can get you a pro bono lawyer, and then people answered and said, don't talk rubbish, pro bono is something else. Maybe just clear all this up once and for all. Where do you go if, God forbid, there's been medical negligence? You go straight to an attorney, what do you do?
Well, Most of the attorneys that practice medical negligence law will take a case on contingency. So that means that you don't need to have money, you don't need to be a person of means. in order to have a case. If you have a case, and the case warrants it, and the attorney that you go to feels that the case warrants it, they will take it on. But you must remember that they are also going to be putting a substantial amount of their own money into the case. So you have to weigh it up when you're looking at a case. And if you're looking at a case and it's going to cost you 500,000 rand to prosecute the case, and you're only going to get and it's only worth 100,000 rand. I mean, if I said to you, as a business deal, put in 500,000 rand for which you'll get a return of 100,000 rand, you're not going to do that.
No.
So I think that it's not in every case where there may be a case that people should be claiming. That's in my view. I've had many, many people phone me up, and I've often told people that I believe that there is a case, but I'm not certain that it's financially viable for them to prosecute that case. And most times people turn around and say, thank you very much for that, you know, for your information, and thanks for talking to me. They got a better understanding now, and they decide not to prosecute a case. But where there's some cases that should be prosecuted, and we're talking about the baby cases, obviously those are cases, in my view, that should be prosecuted because these kids are going to require lifelong care.
Yeah, Greg, you are mandated in 99% of the cases by attorneys that are handling these matters, and you are asked to do the financial calculations for them.
That's correct.
Well, how do you go about that?
Well, we brief generally. We've been briefed by the department. We've been briefed by attorneys that represent the MPS, and we've also been briefed by a plaintiff firm. So we pretty much get briefed by all defendants and plaintiffs. Look, so the actuary's involvement basically in these matters is there's two heads of damages where we're involved. So the one is for future loss of past and future loss of earnings, and then for calculating the capitalized value of future medical expenses. Mm-hmm. So there's normally just to give you some background, there's normally about there's five heads of damages generally that one claims in medical negligence matters: past medical expenses, which are normally just proved easy to prove. Mm. Future medical expenses are there. You've got to rely on a number of experts who give opinions on what the future care of the child will involve. So, in cerebral palsy matters, this often involves the biggest expense generally is caregiving. So the more severe the case, generally there's a requirement for sort of 24-hour care, and that comes at a substantial cost. And then there's a claim for past loss of income that wouldn't apply in a child's case. So there would just be a claim for future loss of income. And then there's general damages, which is basically losses that can't be quantified, such as pain and suffering. So those are the five broad categories. Then actuaries are normally briefed in calculating the capitalized value of future medical expenses, and then the capitalized value of future loss of income.
Obviously, the courts rely on this. This is what they base their judgments on.
Generally, yes. So, I mean, they don't have to adhere to what the actuary calculates. I mean, there are judgments where, they can depart. But my experience in virtually every single cerebral palsy matter that I've been involved in, they've always relied on the actuarial calculations at the end of the day. So,
I have a report here, Greg. It comes off the Sowetan, the Citizen. I'm not quite sure of the date. It says the Gauteng MEC, Health MEC, has agreed to pay over 29.6 million to compensate a Soweto family for the gross negligence of state hospital staff, which resulted in their little girl becoming quadriplegic cerebral palsy. Were you involved in that matter?
I was, yes.
I mean, that's a staggering payout, isn't it? No. 29 million.
Yes, it is.
Is that one of the biggest, or what kind of figures are?
That is one of the biggest that I'm aware of. I think I think Jack Bloom asked the question of the Department of Health what the five biggest payouts were in cerebral palsy matters, and as far as I know, the biggest one is 36 million. Followed by 33 million, and then I think this one was the third biggest, 29.6 million. But the main driver, and Stephen will be able to back me up on it, of why these claims get so large, because people look at the amount and it's staggering, and I think, well, how can it, are you sure you've calculated this correctly? But the cost of care is substantial. So you know, caregivers, full-time caregiving can be $25,000 a month, for example.
Do you remember the negligence aspect of this particular case? What happened there?
I don't remember. We don't often see the negligence. We normally just get to the quantum stage once negligence has been sorted out. So we don't always get full details of every single matter that comes across our desk.
Yeah, Stephen. Yeah.
Can I just add that when you see these amounts that get paid out, one of the big issues, especially when it comes to sort of cerebral palsy kids, is life expectancy. Yeah. So when one instructs somebody like Greg to quantify a matter, one would instruct him that the life expectancy of this child is 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years. So the longer the life expectancy of the child, the greater the award is going to be, because it's the greater the length of time that the child is going to obviously need all of this care. And in cerebral palsy cases in particular, there's a very varied life expectancy. And unfortunately, it is a bit of a thumb suck. It's based on statistics. There are various studies that have been done overseas. So if a child is lying there and cannot roll over or cannot move at all, and they're sort of really just lying and staring at the ceiling, their life expectancy is going to be a lot less than a child who is able to walk, albeit dragging his one leg behind him, for example. The difference between those two, the one may have a life expectancy of 20 years and the other may have a life expectancy of 50 or 60 years. And that's going to make a vast difference to what the quantification of the claim will ultimately be.
I think one of the problems as well is just the application of life expectancy to an individual. So you can never predict how long one person is going to live. You could do that for a large group of individuals. So in statistics, you talk about the law of large numbers. So if you've got a large group of similar individuals, then you can fairly accurately predict what the life expectancy is. But that's an average life expectancy. Now to go and what happens in these matters, you've got to go and apply that average to an individual. So you know one of the concerns of the department as well is that. Let's say the life expectancy is determined at another 25 years, which is the average, but then you could be faced with a situation where the child dies in 3 years' time. Now you've paid out 20 million rand or so, and they're arguing that that money should come back to the state.
Yeah. What does happen to the money? Nothing. Does it stay with the parents?
Well, in terms of our current law, the once and for all rule, as Greg has already alluded to, applies. Which means once there's been a judgment, then that judgment needs to be satisfied. And if the child dies 3 weeks later, then the money would then go to that child's heirs. It doesn't get paid at the present moment. Doesn't get paid back to the state. Mm. That's one of the things that the state
is
advocating.
It's actually a good point. It's a very good point. If something does happen to the child, the parents have walked out with 30 million or whatever it may be.
It's one of the arguments that I think it was the Eastern Cape or the Western Cape Department of Health raised in the Constitutional Court, because they had data on I think it was a rough, I think it was about 45 cases where they found that a few had died before the before the monies had even been paid. So it's got to be. As Stephen said, the whole thing is to determine the life expectancy, and we often have to rely on we can only rely on international studies for that purpose. So there's a California database of cerebral palsy matters where and that's often used as the with an adjustment determines what the life expectancy is in South Africa. So one of the things the Department of Health should be doing is constructing a database of these matters and tracking them over time so that they can get their own handle on life expectancy, because at the moment there's just no feedback loop into the system.
What happens to a medical practitioner or a nurse who's grossly negligent, derelict in the duty? Do they get sanctioned? I mean, do they get fired, or are they still there? What happens to these people?
Would be dependent upon the institution they work for. In the case of a medical practitioner, as we discussed earlier on, that would be a question of whether that medical practitioner is then, reported to the Health Professions Council. Mm. And if they find him or her to be grossly negligent, then they have the power to sanction that person. As I say, the sanction would depend on what the negligence involved or the gross negligence involved. Insofar as the nursing is concerned, there is the Nursing Council of South Africa, and very much the same thing applies. Mm. There, the hospital, well, an individual could report a nurse as well, but very often it's the hospitals that will refer the matter to the nursing council, who will also make an adjudication as to that particular nurse's performance.
Stephen, lastly, are we becoming a bit of a litigious society like the Americans? I mean, is the dentist scared to treat your tooth because if he hurts you, you've got a claim against him? Is that what's happening today? Are there a lot of, I don't include you in this one, but there are a lot of attorneys that handled road accident fund matters that are moving away from that because the law's changing there. And they're looking for new sources of income. It could be medical malpractice.
Well, I think that medical malpractice is a growing concern worldwide. It's not only in this country. If one looks at various articles which I've read, the United States, which is, as you say, is a very litigious society, there are grave concerns about the growing number of medical malpractice claims there, and Canada and so forth. And, you can point all over the world, the medical malpractice there. Is growing for whatever particular reason. And I don't think, I mean, when you say the demise of the Road Accident Fund, well, it hasn't demised yet. The law hasn't yet changed. So maybe practitioners are looking at other avenues of practice, which they haven't previously looked at, and that may be a reason for the increase in, and there's also been so much increase in the awareness of medical malpractice. You know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, it was sort of a case of, you can't sue a doctor, all doctors stick together, so there's no point in suing a doctor. I think that thinking has changed.
Yeah. That's the voice of Stephen Flowers. Are you still advertising all over? I remember your ads just flow thick and fast.
Well,
not on Cliff Central, though. I think we need you here.
Not all over, but we do still advertise.
Yeah. Many thanks. Stephen Flowers, your firm is?
Munro Flowers and Vermaak Attorneys.
In Rosebank, Johannesburg. Cool. They're one of the leading medical malpractice legal firms. And then we also have you haven't given the lot of numbers out, or you're not giving them. scared to be sued.
Not this week.
You could get sued if you've got professional indemnity insurance.
I'm not getting out a lot of numbers.
Okay, well, privately, for a few million, you can give out the lottery numbers. We'll calculate it for people. Many thanks to you, Greg Whittaker of Algorithm Consultants. It's been a great show, Lines.
It was great.
Very interesting, a bit scary.
It's very, law, medical, it's always scary.
Cool. Until next week, we want to thank you very much for listening, and we'll be back with something very exciting next week. See you then.
Please note that the views expressed and the advice provided in this show are for general advice and entertainment purposes only. Nothing stated should be treated as a substitute for your own independent legal advice based on your own specific facts and objectives. Therefore, the presenter and CliffCentral.com accept no liability of any nature whatsoever, either expressed or implied.
Law, like you've never heard it before. The Laws of Life with Gary Hertzberg on CliffCentral.com.
Presenting the Attorney's Fidelity Fund and the Attorney's Insurance Indemnity Fund on CliffCentral.com. Your champions in the legal profession.
Sanbonani, I'm Gary Hertzberg, and this is the Laws of Life on CliffCentral.com. Alongside me today, Lionel Makoko-Klela. Welcome, Lines.
Dumela, Gary, and Dumela to our podcasters.
Yep. Lines, as you know, in the last few podcasts, we've been talking about how many lawyers have in recent times made off with money that have been held in trust on behalf of clients.
Yes.
Obviously, these lawyers didn't start out crooked, mm-hmm. because for a lawyer to practice, he has to have a Fidelity Fund certificate.
Wow.
So joining us today in studio is Simthandile Manyamani. She's the Practitioner Support Manager of the Attorney's Fidelity Fund. A very warm welcome to you.
Thank you, Gary, and good afternoon.
Let's talk about your position as Practitioner Support Manager at Attorney's Fidelity Fund. What actually does that entail?
It entails quite a number of things. One of the things that we do is really to support the practitioners, as the name suggests. How we support them is that we would provide training where it's required. We issue articles through DREBAS, which is a journal that the attorneys use in South Africa. We also support the new practitioners who have just opened new firms, where we go and see if they know how to prepare their accounting records, if they know how to maintain their trust and everything that relates to trust funds. So that's the first leg that we do, and then we provide inspections as well, which is required by the rules. After 4 months of being of opening the firm, we get the first inspection, which is done within the first 6 months. So we provide quite a number of support initiatives that are required out there. We currently, for instance, are writing up a risk management module for the lead, where we actually be talking to the practitioners on how to maintain their risks in their firms, because we've seen that some of them don't know how to do risk assessment. So we're starting to support them to say, this is how you do things.
Mm. Being a lawyer, being a lawyer myself, and being a very proud member of the Law Society, I can say personally, we really value what you do, and you offer all kinds of assistance to us attorneys. So many thanks to you, and keep the good work up.
Thank you.
Let's talk about what a Fidelity Fund certificate is and how a lawyer goes about getting one.
A Fidelity Fund certificate is a certificate that actually entitles a lawyer to practice. What it means is that if you have your own practice, you are a director in an incorporated firm, a partner in a partnership, or a sole practitioner in a sole proprietor, you actually need to have the certificate. And this certificate that is issued by the Law Society. It runs for the period from the 1st of January to 31 December. However, should you be a new practitioner that opened somewhere in the year, you can apply at a point when you open the firm, but the certificate that's issued is only valid up to the 31st of December. How you apply really is that in the past, prior to the issuance of the 2016 ones, the lawyers would complete a form, an application form, and send it to the Law Society. And this was a manual intervention. They would send it to the Law Society. The Law Society would then capture the form onto the system and issue the certificate manually to the lawyer. In 2015, the Attorneys Fidelity Fund actually appointed a service provider who came up with an online application system, which is something that can be used by all the lawyers. The beauty about the system is that you don't have to have a laptop, you don't have to have a desktop. You can actually access the system even from your smartphone, from your tablet, from your iPad, from anywhere. You don't have to be in the office to do the application. So all you do is that you log in and you get your credentials, your login credentials provided to you. When you log in for the first time, there is a section where you're going to put in your ID number and you also put in the email address. You submit it, the system will then send you your login credentials. It is therefore important that as a lawyer, you make sure that the Law Society always has your up-to-date contact details, because if that email address is incorrect, then you will not be able to get it. So you need to make sure that they've got the one that you're using so that it can be sent to that. And then you can log in using those credentials that you receive from the system.
Lance, we may have answered the question. I know you wanted to ask how to apply for
certainly
for the certificate.
Yeah, but since that has been answered, does Fidelity Fund actually operate nationally within South Africa, or is it only based in Pretoria?
We are based in Pretoria. Our head office is in Cape Town, and we have an office where we're operating from. It's an office. It's a branch, and we have another branch in Pietermaritzburg, which is a relatively small branch. But our head office, like I've mentioned, is in Cape Town. We do provide services nationally, although we don't have national presence in terms of the buildings, in terms of location. You don't have people sitting everywhere in the country, but we service everyone in the country.
Yeah, I'm sure us lawyers know how to use the email and phones and the rest, so as long as we've got the major centres, it caters to all of us.
Yeah.
I think the question that Lionel and I want to ask you is, what actually are the requirements to meet before a certificate is actually issued to an attorney?
There are two major requirements that we currently look for. One, we look for an approved audit for the firm. I don't want to say that we're looking for an unqualified audit, because there are instances where initially the audit would be qualified by an auditor for whatever reason. Then the Law Society would send it back for whatever the qualification was to be addressed, and then it becomes unqualified. So you will find that most probably in the system still reflects as qualified. That to us is not important. What's important is whether the Law Society has approved the audit report. Mm-hmm. So if the approval is there, you will still be considered to get your certificate. The second thing that we look for is the practice management training. This is a compulsory training that attorneys who started practicing for the first time for their own account after the 14th of August 2009 must complete, and is offered by the LEAD, which is the Legal Education and Development Unit of the Law Society of the Law Society of South Africa. So if you started practicing for the first time after the 14th of August 2009, you must do that training, unless the Law Society, for whatever reason, actually exempts you from doing it. But that is at the discretion of the Law Society. Yes. So you need to meet those two requirements. And if we look at the issue of the audit report, if, for instance, you are a practitioner who is a director or a partner in more than just one firm, all the firms that you are associated with should have approved audits. If any one of the firms that you are associated with doesn't have an approved audit, then it will actually lead to the withholding of the certificates for the other firms that you are linked with. Because remember, we issue the certificate to an individual, not to a firm. So for an individual to hold the certificate, you should be in good standing in all the firms that you are actually linked to.
I think there's one other thing, that you've got to be up to date with your subscriptions.
Well, the Law Society, like I indicated, is the one that issues the certificate. Mm. So if you are not up to date with your subs or your contributions with the Law Society, they can withhold the issuance of the certificate, even if you do meet the other two requirements.
May I just take a practical example? A client walks into a lawyer's office, a prospective client. He doesn't know whether the lawyer has a Fidelity Fund certificate or not. Mm-hmm. There is no way of demonstrating that, is there? And I don't think it is incumbent upon a prospective client to phone the Law Society and say, has that lawyer a Fidelity Fund certificate?
There's absolutely nothing wrong with the public member if they know that the practitioner should be holding a certificate. Yes. There's nothing wrong with them asking from the Law Society and verifying. Yes. In fact, the intention is that in going into the future, the public member should be in a position to log into a website and see if the attorney that they are approaching does hold one.
Excellent.
So there is something like that is going to come into the future. Yes. But at the moment, not all attorneys display their certificates on the walls, but it is ideal that they do, because for a member of the public who knows that there should be a certificate, it would be a plus to see that certificate. But the beauty, when we get to the time when the member of the public can verify, they can actually even scan that certificate and see if indeed it's a valid certificate or if it's a forged certificate.
Yeah, you know, what you're saying is so accurate, because I had a client the other day who came to see me. His attorney had closed his doors, and he couldn't get hold of him. The attorney didn't answer his calls or anything. I know this is slightly off point. Mm. So he came to me, and I had to phone the Law Society for him, and I had to ask them, has this lawyer closed down, or is he in bad standing, or what is the position? Mm. As you rightly say, I think the public should be able to access that themselves directly, so they know whether the attorney is up to date or not, or has a certificate or not.
Certainly. That's something that we're working towards.
What is the effect, if I may ask as a last question, of on the attorney's part if he doesn't have an up-to-date Fidelity Fund certificate? What's the effect on him and his practice?
The effect on the attorney is that, as the Act correctly points out, or explicitly points out, it first of all says you should hold a certificate for you to practice. Mm. But it also says, in a case where you do practice and you are not in possession of the certificate when you should, you cannot be charging fees. Mm. So effectively, what it translates to is that if you don't have the certificate and you are continuing to provide a service, you should be providing it free of charge, because you're not entitled to a fee or award or disbursement or anything. Mm. So it is critical that an attorney, for them to practice, they must always have a valid certificate.
If the public have any queries, they don't phone the Attorney's Fidelity Fund, they phone the Law Society direct.
You phone the Law Society.
It should come through to you.
Well, the first point of call is the Law Society. They are the regulators. They are the ones who issue the certificate. The Attorneys Fidelity Fund doesn't. Yeah. All the Attorneys Fidelity Fund did was to introduce an online system to facilitate the application, but it is still the Secretary of the Law Society who issues the certificate to the practitioners.
There's a wealth of information on your website that the public can look at, please, and a lot of attorneys should have a look at it as well. Give it to us.
I'm happy you said that. A lot of attorneys certainly have to look at it. For instance, this year we closed on the 31st of March to provide assistance. The fund does provide telephonic assistance, usually in the period between October of a year up to around March of the following year. Because it's a peak period for issuance of certificates, we understand that the law societies cannot handle all the calls. So we do appoint people temporarily to provide the service, and we do indicate on our website when we are going to provide the service and what the contact details of the people who can be contacted are. And once we have closed, we also indicate, unfortunately, some people don't read on our website because they still continue to phone even post the date.
And
you actually expect attorneys to read, because all they deal with really is text, but some of them don't. So they still continue to phone. In a case where we receive a phone call where a person requires assistance, or maybe they have not been assisted by the law society, they couldn't get through for whatever reason, we do provide the service. But your first point of call is the law society.
Many thanks. That's the voice of Sim Tandile Mayamani. She's the practitioner support manager of the Attorneys Fidelity Fund. Thank you for taking time to be with us. A great bit of information. We'll talk to you again.
Thanks, Gary.
Law, like you've never heard it before. The Laws of Life with Gary Hertzberg on CliffCentral.com.
This is CliffCentral.com.